It's a delight to be back with you. Let's move forward quickly. We worked our way through the Northern Kings, found out that all of them were bad, and now we're working our way through the Southern Kings and showing you where the prophets, the writing prophets, fit in historically to these events. We finished with Jeremiah last week, the weeping prophet, whose preaching career lasted through five different kings. You know, he was ultimately carried off down into Egypt, mistreated there. He really had a rough life. And, you know, like Job, the Lord won't allow us to go through more than we're able to handle. But some of us apparently can handle more than others. And there have been some Bible characters that have been through a lot of things that you and I perhaps have been spared having to deal with. Well, let's move to Habakkuk. What an amazing preacher he was. He, perhaps more than any of the other prophets, explained the rationale, the divine rationale for why God would let the entire nation be carried off into Babylonian captivity. This commenced in 606. There were three successive deportations beginning in 606. Nebuchadnezzar was the Babylonian monarch that was on the throne. Jehoiakim was on the throne of Judah. And here is the southern kingdom facing national calamity. God, being a long-suffering God and a very tolerant God, nevertheless has an end to his long-suffering nature. There is an attribute, a characteristic of God that we all need to face up to and recognize. This book deals with the theme or the concept of righteousness. You know, in our English versions, the word righteous and the word justice, righteousness and justice is the same word. Maybe we don't think of those being the same concept, but they are. Do you remember the layout of this book where Habakkuk, he's like, I cannot believe the nation is so wicked, all these evil things going on, in that kind of way you feel about America. And so he was whining to God, how long are you going to put up with it? How can a just God put up with this? He said, God responded and said, I'm going to punish the nation. I'm going to bring the Babylonians in. And you remember Habakkuk's response there? Whoa, time out. The Babylonians are worse. How can you use a more wicked country to punish a less wicked country? By the way, that raises questions about America. You know, Muslim countries or other countries that we would say, well, you know, they've got false religion and they're directly opposed to God. Surely God would never use them to punish America that, you know, generally speaking, has at least had a Christian worldview. Oh, yes, he will. Habakkuk is a prime example. And you remember after Habakkuk said that, God came back to him and said, I'm going to use the Babylonians to punish my people, and then they're going to get theirs. So God's not unjust in using various countries and forces in the world to do his bidding without interfering with their will and their decision-making power. What a powerful book. So God's power to execute just punishment is certainly not contrary to his love, his mercy, or his justice. Chapter 3 concludes the book with a sort of a praise, extolling God, who is unreproachable. He cannot ever be charged with being unjust, unfair, partial, or unrighteous. See, God has never, ever, in 6,000 years of human history, ever treated anybody unfairly. That would directly contradict his very nature, character, and integrity. So when you read through the Bible and see where God does certain things and you think, whoa, that seems a little over the top. Well, it's our moral sensibilities that need to be adjusted there because God's always done right. He's never done anything wrong. And, you know, this is the book that has this tremendous verse that's quoted three times in the New Testament. The just shall live by faith. What a powerful passage. The just, that is, the righteous person, shall live, that is, function, survive, exist by his faith. That is his faithfulness. The way for you and me to survive life and to get through this life, if we're going to be righteous people, is to live an obedient, faithfully obedient lifestyle before God. That's how we can live. That's how we can make it. That's how we can get into eternity in fine fashion. Now, Daniel, we typically think of more in terms of the post-Babylonian era, but he was, the southern kingdom was still intact when he himself was carried off into Babylonian captivity in that first deportation in 606 B.C. He lived apparently to be well into his 90s, we think, and therefore, having been carried in at the very beginning, his life spanned the entire 70-year captivity, plus then on into the Medo-Persian period that was responsible for taking down Babylonia. He so conducted himself, you remember, that he was elevated in Nebuchadnezzar's government, and apparently successive kings pretty much recognized his value to their reign, and so he was able to pretty much rub elbows with royalty and top government officials during his entire stay in captivity. And you remember he was the recipient of some hostility. And yet he stayed faithful despite all of that, lived long enough not only to see the demise of the Babylonian Empire, but the rise of the Persians in league with the Medes and successive kings that were there. We think he wrote around 530 B.C., shortly after King Cyrus came in and took over Babylon in 539. So that's kind of a layout. I would suggest to you that a phrase used several times in the book, four times, is a good central theme. The Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. We need to remember that right now, because there are all kinds of things going on in our country politically, are there not? And then look around the world at everything that's happening. Well, don't think God's aloof, detached, and disconnected and uninvolved. He is not. He has always ruled in the kingdoms of men. And I'm absolutely convinced that he's doing so today. His will and his purposes cannot be thwarted. He will accomplish his intentions no matter what course human history takes. God's power and protection are such that you and I can count on him even if adversity and political turmoil is taking place. All of this, of course, came to an end, and he pointed us to the ultimate outcome, as all these prophets do, in terms of the coming Christ. Look how this book lays out. The first six chapters, very historical, just matter-of-fact, recording history, including, you know, the being in the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the large image that Nebuchadnezzar set up. These are all just historical events. And then suddenly you shift in chapter 7 through 12, the last half of the book, to apocalyptic material, visions written in this special type of terminology that is very much characterized by the book of Revelation. And so that's kind of a layout of that book, and what a great fellow that went through an awful lot and set a great example. Then we have Ezekiel. He was carried off into exile in the second deportation, so we're talking about 597. About 10,000 others. You see, when Daniel was carried off, all they did was take some of the young Jewish nobility. That's why those three friends were with him. For re-indoctrination purposes, remember they clothed them in Babylonian clothing, taught them the Babylonian language, gave them Babylonian names. So there was some, you know, that's kind of a propaganda plan there to try to effect change among the captives. And then in the second deportation, they took about 10,000 on this occasion. And it's still, you know, about 10 or 11 years before the final deportation occurs and the nation is completely brought down. Ezekiel moved to a little village, Tel Abib, on the banks of Nebuchadnezzar's royal canal, called in the text the Chebar River. And he was about 5 years there before God called him, as he did, these prophets to speak what he wanted spoken to them. Fairly young himself, his wife died within 5 years of that. And he preached for about 22 years. Jeremiah was still back in Palestine. He had not been carried off into captivity. So he's still there preaching to those that were remaining in Jerusalem and area. Habakkuk and Zephaniah were rough contemporaries of this period as well. All of these very prominent figures coming together, doing their role in their various respective locations. So here's kind of the central theme, a portion of God's people now in captivity, the rest soon to come. And Ezekiel is stressing to them that this is all in God's plan, and it's been brought on because of the way you all have behaved. And so don't resist it. You know, all of these prophets stressed over and over and over, don't resist. Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. This is God's way of dealing with you. What you need to do is straighten up your life and repent and be right. And ultimately, when all of this comes to an end, there will be a remnant that will be permitted to return. This book is about the sovereignty of God. We maybe do not stress that enough because, I don't know if we're reacting to the Calvinistic misemphasis on the concept, but it certainly is a fundamental character of the very nature of God. He controls the universe, and he exercises initiative as he pleases, again, without interfering with our free will. That would not be fair or just. He lets us decide where we want to spend eternity. But he is very operative, and some 65 times in this book you have this statement, "Then they will know that I am the Lord." That's affirming his sovereignty and his right to be the ultimate ruler. Well, we come to the last king, and Zedekiah, like the other kings, continued to resist God. He himself was a very sinful man. And finally, in 587, 586, the Babylonians came back for a third time, and this time they went for broke. Nebuchadnezzar was still on the throne. You know, in those days, these ancient armies would lay siege to capital cities, primary urban areas. And these besiegements could last for months, sometimes for years. You know, ultimately, I guess you're trying to starve them out if you can't breach the walls. So that went on for a good while, and then finally they were able to breach the walls. They entered into the city in Jerusalem and began, you know, of course, killing Judeans right and left. They sacked and pillaged the wonderful, beautiful temple that Solomon had built. They carried off most or all of the contents of all the gold and all of that sort of thing. Zedekiah had left himself, I guess you would call it, kind of an escape hatch, a portal near the royal gardens where he escaped, headed out across the plains of Jericho, trying to elude his Babylonian pursuers, but they were in hot pursuit, overtook him, transported him to a little village up in northern Palestine, Riblah, where Nebuchadnezzar had set up his judgment seat. And they brought Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, before him. And then they brought Zedekiah's two sons to the judgment seat. And then they murdered those two boys while dad stood there and watched. And notice that scene forever imprinted upon his mind, because they then promptly gouged out his eyes, blinding him for life, put shackles on him, and led him off into Babylonian captivity along with thousands and thousands of others. And as we said, there they remained for 70 years. And that was ultimately then the close. Really, when you think about it, that's kind of the end of Israelite history. We mentioned that the northern tribes, there's nothing more said about them. For all practical purposes, that's it. God was no longer dealing with them. They did continue to deal with Judah because of these promises to Abraham to bring Christ into the world. And so a faithful remnant was permitted to return at the end of that 70-year period. So Israel went off into Assyrian captivity in 722 BC. Here is the way the writer of Kings summarizes that event. The Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. And then Judah lasted somewhat longer, three deportations coming to a close in 586. Here's how the writer of Kings summarizes that. He finally cast them out of his presence, just booted them out of his presence. That is the God of the Bible, and he did no wrong when he did all of this. All right, now we turn to the fact that the rest of our Old Testaments is dealing with post-exilic circumstances. They come out of the exile after the 70-year period. And here are the writing prophets that we have and the chronicles. Notice that the chronicles, we think a lot about being like kings, but they have a very specific purpose that differs from the others. Let's mention Ezra. He lived about 450 BC and wrote the book of Ezra, a very prominent figure in this returning remnant after the 70-year period of captivity. It was successive Persian monarchs that issued decrees allowing conquered peoples to return to their ancestral homelands. Ezra led one of those groups shortly after Cyrus overthrew Babylon in 539. Cyrus, Darius, Artaxerxes. You know, I was a substitute teacher years ago in Memphis, and there was a kid from Iran. Iran is the old Persia. Muslim, very Muslim. And I asked him if he had ever heard of, I think I pronounced it Darius or Darius, and he just looked puzzled. I said, he's a king in your history. And he thought for a minute, and he went, Dariush. So look at the word, Dariush. That makes sense. Same character. So he was familiar with that, although I'm sure that the Muslims don't appreciate much of their past history. Three separate waves of Jewish exiles we mentioned. Ezra records two of those. Nehemiah records the third. All of these fellows contemporaries, roughly, Haggai, Zechariah, Esther, Malachi, and Nehemiah. Ezra has the six chapters describing the return of this remnant, this element, back to Palestine under Zerubbabel. And the major feature of that return was the reconstruction of the temple. Haggai steps onto the scenes of time, begins preaching and telling them, look, you've got your own houses rebuilt, and here God's house remains in ruins. You need to get busy and get it done. And within a matter of months, they were motivated to complete that. He was joined by Zechariah, who also urged the rebuilding of the temple and also kind of a messianic type prophet. He predicted Jesus was coming and the people should repent and conduct themselves properly. All right, that's the first section of Ezra. Then the last half, verses chapter 7 through 10, describe the actual return under Ezra. But look how I've left a space there, because sandwiched into the middle of the book of Ezra is the story of Esther. And this is an amazing, amazing story. I know you love it, like many of these accounts. By this time, the Persian king is Xerxes I. The Hebrew terminology, Ahasuerus, that's his name in Hebrew. So there's his reign for you, 483 to 473. His palace was built in one of the capital cities, Shushan. Some translations have Susa and perhaps even some other variants. The Babylonian Empire had come to an end. The Persians had stepped in, and I'm telling you, Xerxes had control over a wide geographical area that extends from what we today would call North Africa around Egypt and all the way over to the vicinity of India and China. Let's spend a little bit of time this evening talking about this incredible book. You know, it's an astounding book. It has as its purpose, like many of these books, including books like Ruth. There's so much wonderful detail in there that we may miss the main point. The main point is that God is not going to allow the Jews to be eliminated to where God cannot fulfill his promise to bring Jesus into the world. Okay, so that is the point of Ruth. That's the point of Esther and some of these other books. The whole story of Joseph, that's the point. So look at how this lays out. And remember now, this isn't fairy tale stuff. This is history. This actually happened. Here is this Xerxes. He extends his empire over a geographical location that's divided up into 127 provinces. So, you know, a massive area, far larger than the United States. And you remember how the book opens by informing us that he wants to kind of show off. Remember when you were a kid in school and your friend said, don't be a show off? He was a show off. He got all of his top military officials throughout his empire, the nobles, the princes, brought them all to his presence. And then for the next 6 months, took these guys on a grand tour, showing them all of the splendor of his empire, the treasures that he had, all of his great might and splendor. And then at the end of that period, he implemented a week-long banquet in which he just gave these guys anything they wanted to eat or drink. And he threw this party in the royal gardens, which was kind of a big enclosed garden Meanwhile, his wife, Queen Vashti, chose to throw a banquet for the women, just the female population, and that was in a different location within the confines of the palace. Well, you remember toward the end of that week, he's basically inebriated and gets this idea, you know, this is so typical of men that can be so stupid in their disrespect for their wives. He gets the idea that he wants to show her off to all these ogling men. And so he sends, you know, couriers to her and commands her to come and present herself wearing her crown in the presence of all of these guys, and she refuses to do it. The Bible doesn't tell us why, but I can only assume that that was an assault upon her femininity and upon her dignity, and it would be humiliating. It would make her, what, feel like a piece of meat, would be one of the expressions we use nowadays. And it would affect, you know, when you think about it, it would affect her sense of modesty. Now, we can spend a lot of time talking about female modesty in America today. There doesn't seem to be out here in the world the same kind of sense of modesty that even this pagan woman had in our own country. But that clearly, I think, was where she was coming from, and so she refused to come. Well, that enraged the king, and so he turned to his prominent legal advisors and said, what should we do about this? What's the law saying? They said, the law says she's got to be deposed. She's violated the law of the land, the law of the king, the word of the king. Plus, that's going to impact the rest of the female population, see men, when they're in charge. And so they said, you've got to remove her from the queenship, take her crown. So he goes along with that. And you remember how after he sobers up and starts thinking about things, he has second thoughts about it. And I think they realized that and realized that if she were to be reinstated, you know, she might want to know who it was that urged the king to go ahead with that. And so they very quickly say, you know what you need to do? You need to hold a beauty contest and have the most beautiful women in all 127 provinces brought, and then you can make a selection as to who's going to be the new queen. And he decides to go along with that, which again tells you something about men. And you remember how we are informed that in the city of Shushan, the capital city, there was this Jewish man, Mordecai, who, by the way, had been carried off into Babylonian captivity back when Jehoiachin was the king. Nebuchadnezzar was the Babylonian king. He was carried from Jerusalem into Babylonian captivity. And here he is now, the country having shifted to a Persian emphasis. And his aunt and uncle had died. They left a young girl, apparently much younger than him. And that would be his cousin. But he decided to take her in and raise her as his own child, sort of a father-daughter relationship. And this was at a point in his life and her life where he felt like it would be appropriate for him to enroll her in this beauty contest. And so he does that. And I'm telling you, women come from all over. And it's a big, long ordeal and preparations and so forth. But she captures the attention of this pagan king. He wants her, and he puts her on the throne and gives her a crown, and she replaces Vashti. And he calls a nationwide celebration, holiday sort of thing, and lavish the population with gifts as a result. In the meantime, we are informed that Mordecai, who, by the way, had attained some sort of political standing in the government, the terminology that's consistent in these old documents is that he sat at the king's gate. In other words, he was a courtier. He had some type of responsibilities in a governmental sense and therefore was recognized for his governmental position. Well, somehow he gets wind from these two fellows that are described as gatekeepers. They have special responsibility with regard to the king. But the king had done something that made these two guys mad, and so they entertained a conspiracy to assassinate Xerxes. And Mordecai somehow finds out about it. He tells Esther about it. She goes to the king. The king investigates the situation and finds that it's true and has the two men hung. Well, in the meantime, we are informed of this character Haman. We're not told exactly how he rose to power, what it was that caused Xerxes to think so highly of him, but he elevates this guy all the way above the other nobles and princes to high status, almost like the second-hand man of the king of, of the entire empire. And Haman is an extremely wealthy man, and the king even goes so far, he's apparently won the favor of the king to the extent that the king orders everybody to, when they see Haman coming, you're supposed to stop and bow and offer him appropriate honor. And so, you know, as this is going on, he's going around, everybody's bowing to him, and I think he's so vain and so focused on that he doesn't notice that this Jewish man Mordecai is not doing it. And some of his associates pointed out to him one day, say, do you not realize that this Jew is not, they say Jew, is not bowing to you? And so Haman starts paying attention. And the next time he's out there in public and sees him at the gate, he sees, sure enough, he's not showing any indication that he has any reverence or honor for me, any respect. And it just infuriated him to no end, but he chose not to do anything about it. Instead, he went to the king. And here's what he says to the king. He says, you know, there is an ethnic group that is scattered throughout your empire. And these people are not in your best interests. Their customs and everything are very different from all the other nationalities and people that are in the kingdom. They won't obey the king. It's not in your best interest for them to be kept around. What you need to do is issue a decree that eliminates them. I mean annihilate them. And I don't know why Xerxes, you know, political power can go to a person's head. They can be non-attentive to what's going on in society and in their own kingdom. Absolute power corrupts people. And so he just takes off his royal signet ring off his finger, which is, you know, the thing that ancient monarchs would use to authenticate decrees, governmental documents that would go forth with all the authority of the throne behind them. He tosses that to Haman and says, do whatever you need to do. Haman said, I'll put, it's something like, you know, over 350 tons of silver into the treasury if you'll do this. But he throws him the signet ring and says, do what you think needs to be done and keep your money. So he does that. He calls together the royal secretaries and all the parchments, and they begin writing these decrees. You see, they had to do it in every nationality because this is a multicultural group scattered out over this wide geographical area. So they write this decree in all these different languages, commit them to the royal couriers who ride fast horses. In those days, horses were specifically bred for the government, for the king, that were fast horses, to get these kinds of things expedited. And they spread out to all 127 provinces and issued this decree. And the decree says that on a certain day, on a certain month, which is about 11 months into the future, all of the people in all these provinces are to arm themselves and annihilate the Jews and plunder their goods. You can take whatever a Jew owns and eliminate them from our country. And he continues to dine with the king. And that's kind of the end of that, as far as the king is concerned. Well, you remember when the word of this then got out, the Jews all over the empire go into a state of mourning and grieving, and specifically there in Shushan, the Jewish population is in deep grief. Mordecai himself, as we said, tears his clothes, typical of their expression of that. He dresses in sackcloth, that was also typical. They sit on ashes, and they do a lot of loud wailing and you know, that's kind of odd to Americans, but there are cultures even today, you've seen them on television, where when there's something that's happened, a death or whatever, at their funeral, the women will wail and make all kinds of noise, just different culture, and that's what was taking place even with Mordecai. Word of that gets back to Esther. You know, your cousin's out here, he's very upset, he's mourning, and so she sends one of her assistants to go find out what's going on, and he explains to her, and in fact gives a copy of the decree to the fellow to take back and let her read it for herself. And he says, you need to do something about this. You need to go before the king and get this stopped. And she sends the message back through the fellow and says, I can't do that. You know, Persian law is such that you do not go before the king unsummoned. And if you do, you are killed, executed on the spot by his attendants, unless he holds out the golden scepter that says that he approves of you approaching him. And so she said, you know, how's that going to work? And he writes back to her and says, look at the terminology. It's so astounding and so powerful. He says, don't think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of the Jews will escape. You know, if you remain silent, listen to this. If you don't help us with this, if you stay silent, I believe God's going to get help from somewhere else. And you will perish along with the rest of us. But how do you know that you have not come to this point in your life, been put in this position for just such a time as this? Well, I think she felt a little bad about how she had been kind of resistant. So she wrote him back and said, you're right, I'm going to do it. If you all will fast along with me and my maidens for 3 days, then I'll go in and take a chance. And you remember how she does that very bravely. And he's sitting on his throne, and I don't know how big the throne room was, but he could see through an open area into the main court area hallway. And he sees her out there. So before she ever comes in, he holds the scepter out and she approaches him and touches it. And, you know, he hadn't seen her for over a month. And he says, you know, what would you like? What's your request? Why are you here? Whatever you ask for, I'll give it to you up to half of my kingdom. And she very quickly says, well, I'd like for you and Haman to come to a banquet that I've prepared today at my place. And then I'll talk to you further about that. And so, boy, he sends for Haman, and Haman comes, and you remember they then head over to her place. And in the meantime, Haman comes, and they have this wonderful banquet. And as they're eating, the king again says, you know what? What exactly are you wanting? Because I'll give you up to half my kingdom. She says, well, come again tomorrow for another meal. And then I promise I'll tell you. I don't know if she's just having trouble getting it out. Maybe she's afraid that if she just says, you know, hey, he's issued a decree, we're going to kill, he's going to say, well, you know, that's law and there's nothing I can do about it. I don't know. But he agrees to do that. So they go their separate ways. Haman is just as happy as he can be because not only, you know, is he so wealthy and popular and famous and everything, but here he's just attended a banquet with the king himself and the queen. Until he gets out there in the public square and he sees Mordecai. And he pays close attention this time. Not only does Mordecai not stand up when he comes into his presence, he could tell just from Mordecai's nonverbal signals that he had no fear of Haman. He had no respect and no fear. You know, I wish the Bible told us what's going on there. Is Mordecai perceptive enough to know that this is an evil man and felt that it really would be against his moral principles to pay feigned homage to such a person? I don't know. But he was courageous because this is a high political official that has a lot of clout with the king. He restrains himself and goes on home. And you remember his wife, Zeresh, is there, and he calls some of his friends together. And look at the ego of this guy. He begins recounting all of his wealth and all of his sons and all the things that he's accomplished in the government. And he says, in fact, today I'm the only person that the queen invited to come for a meal with she and her husband. And yet none of this is satisfying to me as long as that Jew, Mordecai, refuses to show me the proper respect that he should show me. Well, Zeresh, ladies, here's the influence of a woman. Now, it's amazing that the Bible principle, the Bible teaching from the garden forward is that God wants the men to step up and take the lead in the church and in the home. That's just the standard cross-cultural, all ages, all periods of time. That's how God created us. That's how he wants it. But that's not to say that women do not have unbelievable power and control and influence. They do. And that's evident throughout history, throughout Bible history. And so her influence is negative. She says, you need to go out here, build a 75-foot gallows and hang him. You know, you got a lot of power. You got the king to do this decree to kill all these Jews. Just go ahead and kill him. Get it over with. He says, that's a great idea. And he must have immediately set carpenters busy that evening. You know, we're in the late afternoon, early evening. He gets them busy constructing this gallows. I suppose they worked all night to get this thing done. Well, that night, you remember that for some unexplained reason, the king can't sleep. I don't think they had Somanex and some of the other sleep aids that we have today, so he did what maybe you do, watch TV or read until you get sleepy. So he calls for the chronicles, the annals of his kingly career, brought by these attendants, and commands them to begin reading. And you remember, as they're reading, they come to the record of how Mordecai had saved the king from an assassination plot from these two fellows that intended to do him in. And even though the king had known about that, it just, nothing had been done about it. So he asked them, has anything been done to honor Mordecai? And they said, nothing. Well, by this time, you know, the sun's coming up, it's daylight hours. And Haman has left his home, headed straight to the palace, because he wants to get permission, authorization from the king to go ahead and hang Mordecai, get this over with. And so he has come into court, and as this conversation is going on with Xerxes, Xerxes says, well, who's in court? And one of the fellows says, well, Haman has just arrived. Send him in here. And as soon as Haman comes in, no doubt poised to say, hey, I have a favor to ask, let me kill Mordecai. Before you get those words out, Xerxes says, Haman, I want to ask you a question. What do you think should be done for the person that the king wants to show great honor to? And here's this vain, egotistical man. He's thinking, he's talking about me. So he conjures up, obviously, what he would like done to him. He says, king, what I think you ought to do, take a royal robe that you yourself have worn, and take a royal steed, a horse that you yourself have ridden, one with one of those crests, you know, coming up on the forehead of the horse. And I think you ought to put that robe on that fellow and set him on that horse, and then select a very high-ranking governmental official, one of the nobles, and have him lead that horse through the streets of Shushan, making the announcement everywhere he goes, this is what is done for the individual that the king wants to honor. And Xerxes says, that's a great idea. Go do that for me, and here's who I want you to do it for. Mordecai the Jew. Now, can you imagine his reaction? First stunned, and then seething. And he gets that robe and that horse, and he goes out there. And for what, several hours, probably on into the afternoon, he's walking through the streets with this Jew that he hates, making this announcement. When he drops him back off at the gate and goes home, he is so mad, he calls again his wife and his other friends together and tells them what has happened, and look at their reaction. Oh, buddy, you're headed down. You are facing a downfall. And they, too, make reference to his ethnicity. This is a Jew before whom your downfall has commenced. Remember now, historically, you would think that they would have been aware of some other incidents in Jewish history, like Daniel in the lion's den, or that fiery furnace. They probably knew about that. So the Jews kind of had a reputation. Their God's real. He really comes to their aid. So they basically said, you're in trouble. You are now in trouble. And they no sooner finish that little discussion that a couple of the kingly assistants show up, officers, in order to escort him to the banquet that he has been invited to with the queen and the king. And so off he goes, no doubt still fuming and disconcerted about what he's been told, even by his wife. He shows up at the banquet. They're eating together. And once again, the king says to Esther, all right, you know, tell me, give me your request. I'm going to give you up to half my kingdom. And she says, well, okay. My request, sir, is I'd like for you to save my life and the life of my people, because a decree has been made and I'm going to be killed and they're going to be killed. And Xerxes says, who in the world would make such a law as that? And she uses this term, vile. That vile, wicked Haman. And I'm telling you, he jumps up, walks out of the room, goes out into the royal gardens, no doubt trying to calm himself and get some clear thinking going. Well, Haman realizes, king's going to kill me. He's mad. So he's thinking, I'm going to have to throw myself on the mercy of Esther and hope that she will intervene so that he won't kill me. So he kind of falls down on this kind of reclining couch like those cultures would use where she's kind of stretched out. He kind of falls down there and he's going to beg her for his life just when the king comes back out of the garden and sees this and says something to the effect, oh, now you're going to molest her right here in front of me too? And I mean, when he said that, as if the queen was being threatened, there's attendants that are standing around, guards. They rush over and they take custody. They take Haman into custody and cover his head. And one of those attendants said, you know, king, he's built a 75-foot gallows out here because he wanted to kill Mordecai, and Mordecai's the guy that saved your life. Xerxes says, hang him on it. And then you remember, Mordecai was invited to the palace, and he is literally given the role, the position, and the possessions of Haman. He's elevated to that post. And when he and Esther beg the king, you know, what are we going to do about this decree that Haman concocted? And you remember, the Persians had this law. It was a standard law, which I think is a foolish law. It has to be. That once the king makes a decree, it cannot be recalled or reversed, even by the king himself. That just doesn't make sense. So he said, I've given you the signet ring, so do what you need to do in order to sort that out, if you have to make alternate decrees or whatever. Well, Mordecai's a sharp fellow, you know. He is. He's a sharp fellow. And so he calls together the royal secretaries, has them write letters in all these languages, and the gist of it is to announce to the entire population that on the same day that this other decree is to take effect, another decree is to take effect. And that decree is to enable all Jews throughout the nation, throughout the empire, to protect themselves, to arm themselves, and to inflict bodily harm and death upon anybody that tries to harm them. And you remember that the Jews, as a result of that, that particular event, instigated a national holiday. I assume it's still practiced or observed by Jewish populations today. And that holiday comes from a Persian word, Pur, P-U-R, which means lots, the casting of lots, which they did in order to determine the day. And so Purim is a feast or holiday observance that the Jewish culture observes, specifically because of this event, this historical event in Jewish history. Now remember, I suggested to you that the point of this book is that if all of the Jews had been annihilated, then God's promises to Abraham would have been come to no effect. If you're going to have Jesus genetically born into a body that is related to Abraham, then there's going to have to be some descendants of Abraham living at that time. And from all we can tell historically, this was such a large geographical area. The Jews had all been confined in Palestine, but Babylonian captivity drove them out into these other areas. And so all of the Jews were situated within the realm of the Persian Empire. And if they had all been annihilated, that would have been the end of God's promises. So then you come to the second central theme of this book, or the second central subject matter, and that's the providence of God. That's astounding. Look at this. The name of God does not even appear in this book, the only one in all the Bible where it doesn't appear. But is he not on every page of it? And look how all of these seemingly disconnected minor events, every one of them necessary in order for the outcome to be what it was. You know, for example, lack of sleep. Why could the king not sleep that particular night? Maybe it was the food that Esther prepared for him earlier in the day. I don't know. But you see, if he had not been unable to sleep, he would not have called for the annals to be read, which would bring about the situation with Mordecai. Why was it that Esther was even put into a position where she could approach the king to try to nullify this decree that would call for the annihilation of the Jews? Well, the previous queen, because her husband was in a drunken stupor, refused to sacrifice her feminine modesty. Now, what if she had been a queen where she said, well, I'm not going to lose my standing. Okay, I'll go out and I'll show myself. But because she had virtue and stood up to the king, that created a series of events that put Esther into that position. I mean, you can go through these stories like this and see event after event after event, almost like links in a chain that are all necessary to be connected in order for God's will to be accomplished. And again, the astounding thing about this, God never interferes with anybody's free will. He doesn't enter into somebody's mind where they're just walking along one day and then suddenly they kind of get the idea that, oh, I think I'll go do this. And that's God miraculously directing them. I don't believe that happens. In fact, I don't believe that ever happened, even in the age of miracles. God didn't work that way. He does not interfere with your spirit's right to make your own decisions in order for you to decide where you want to spend eternity. That is a fundamental feature of the integrity and character of God. And so all these individuals playing out this drama, so to speak, most of the people in this whole story are pagan. They're not Jewish. They don't know the one true God. They believe in many gods. The Persians did. And yet here they are being used in history. Even this famous King Xerxes, whose prominence and power in world history is astounding, the way he's depicted from what we know about him and the influence that he had and the military that he put together. You know, it would take like, when he marched his military somewhere, when the front ranks got to their destination, it'd take about another 7 days for the rest of the army to get there. It's that massive. This was a very prominent person in human history that, again, you and I just probably don't think much about in terms of, okay, so who was he? These were very prominent, influential people. And yet God was right there ruling in the kingdoms of men. What do you think's going on today with God? We don't have a prophet to tell us. It'll probably only be from eternity that we can look back and say, oh, I see why that happened, because that had an impact on this, and this is how this affected the spiritual condition of the church, God's people, or the spiritual condition of America. We can be assured the same God that was active at that time, 2,500 years ago, still alive and well, and is still operating in the kingdoms of men. He has the ability to do it, the will to do it, and he certainly has the wisdom and knowledge to do it. All of this material is available. I know you put it on your website, but it's available in CD format and in VD format, DVD format. And it's also, this kind of material is available on our website. Next week, we're going to have time to do this. You may not think we are, but we're going to have time to finish up the Old Testament. We're nearly done with it. I want to walk you through some of these latter prophets, concluding with Malachi. And then I could give you, a suitable summary of the New Testament so that you can have a kind of an overarching feel for the book. Most of us are far more familiar with the New Testament than we are with the Old, so we won't spend as much time on it, but I'll try to quickly summarize the books, spend a little bit of time on Revelation, and then bring our trip through the Bible to a close. You've been very kind to be attentive and listen to this material. Let's pause and pray before Dwayne says what he wants to say. Holy God, we marvel at your majesty, your power, your sovereignty that you have exhibited through all these thousands of years of human history, how you have enacted all of this coming out of eternity and implementing time and human existence. And we realize, Father, that all of this is directed toward your ultimate desire that none of us perish, but that we all be permitted to live with you in eternity. And we realize that most people in human history have rejected you. We realize that we, your people, are frail and prone to falling spiritually, and we are susceptible to sin. We acknowledge that, Father, but we also express to you our genuine, deep desire to be right with you, to be acceptable to you. And we pray that you will help us to examine our lives very carefully, not be so caught up in the day-to-day humdrum of activities that we fail to realize that you are still operating in our lives, and that every single one of us are very well where we are, who we are, doing what we're doing for such a time as this. Help us to feel the awesome responsibility that we have to not displease you or let you down, but to rise to the occasion and be the people that you want us to be. We're so grateful for all you've done for us through Christ, and in him we pray.